Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You are listening to the Mother of All Talk Shows podcast with George Galloway.
And this is London, but coming to you, of course, all over the world, thanks to the wonders of the internet. Where do I start? I could take the entire show summarizing the extraordinary events on both sides of the Atlantic and indeed across the world, but I don't have time to do all of that. Let me start with Boris Johnson. He did have a death-defying spell in hospital where the doctors and nurses said it was touch and go. You might have thought that a man recovering from such ailments and with a newborn baby in tow might have been permitted a bit of peace in his own country on holiday, but not a bit of it. He was 3 days on holiday in Applecross, in Western Ross, in the Highlands of Scotland. And that is a clue, because the Member of Parliament for the Highlands and Islands, one Ian Blackford, is being accused by all and sundry of having leaked the exact location of Boris Johnson and his family and their security detail to somebody. He says he did not do so publicly, but he emphasised the word publicly. One thing's for sure, the kind of people that hang around the Scotland-England border like ghouls in white NBC suits shouting at motorists to get the F out of Scotland, who carry around banners to Scottish airports and Scottish railway stations saying England out of Scotland. If they'd said Ireland out of Scotland or Pakistan out of Scotland, they'd all be under arrest. But you're allowed to say that in Scotland under the SNP government. Indeed, dog whistle politics more or less commands it. Now, here's the rub. Ian Blackford is no ordinary Scottish nationalist. He's not even an ordinary SNP MP. He's a privy councillor. He's the leader of the SNP in Parliament. Now, if he divulged the Prime Minister's holiday whereabouts to others, then the Speaker of the House of Commons, Lindsay Hoyle, a man I know well, a man of great rectitude, is honour-bound, I would say, to hold a standards and privileges inquiry into the conduct of a privy councillor. The privy council itself has a responsibility to protect the life of the Prime Minister of Britain on holiday in his own country and who was potentially placed in danger by a security leak. Not the first one, by the way. When Johnson was in Scotland just a few weeks ago, on the internet, Scottish nationalists, extremists, were posting details of his helicopter flight plan, information that could potentially have been of use to a terrorist. And I don't know why the security services have not felt the collar of the man who leaked those helicopter flight plans. I don't know why the law does not feel the collar of whomsoever leaked the whereabouts of Boris Johnson on holiday. Now, he said he didn't say anything publicly, but of course he did on Twitter. Somebody, Torquil Crichton of the Daily Record, posted that the midges were ferocious. These are, I think, specifically Scottish insects that are so virulent that anyone camping in Scotland is taking their life in their hands. Torquil Crichton said, for fair-haired, fair-skinned people, these midges can be awful. And Ian Blackford, Privy Councillor Ian Blackford, then tweeted, I wonder if an Eton educated individual learned how to deal with midges. Thus, he did publicly identify the area in which the Prime Minister was staying in Wester Ross. But the exact location may well have been leaked by someone else. But we need an inquiry to establish that. It is also possible, as our poll makes clear, that it was the midges themselves that drove Boris Johnson homeward to think again. Or it could have been a domestic. He has, of course, some form in that regard. But the most likely source was the Scottish nationalist. So you can vote now. Was Boris Johnson driven out of his holiday cottage by A, midges, B, a domestic, C, Scottish nationalist? You can vote now on my Twitter feed at George Galloway. Let me move on, but staying in Scotland, we'll be talking to Brian Wilson, CBE, former Labour minister, about a hate crimes bill, which the aforementioned SNP, you might think it ironic, has tabled in the Scottish legislative programme. It's opposed by the Faculty of Advocates, Scotland's lawyers, the Scottish Police Force, the Catholic Church, and Uncle Tom Cobley and all say this is a very bad idea, which could lead to people being sent to prison for having offended someone they have never seen or met, had no intention of offending, and were merely expressing, even in private, their own personal opinion. That road is a very dangerous road to travel. Freedom of speech, if it means anything, is the freedom to speak of those you like least. Otherwise, it's meaningless as a rubric. It's meaningless as a plank of the platform on which we as a country claim to stand. Now, in parenthesis, let me just say, I've just read that the British Army has been training the army of Belarus. I saw some demonstrators on the streets. Who knew we had so many Belarusians in London? But I just saw some protesting. I wonder if they are aware that the last dictator in Europe, his army is being trained by the British Army. Well, why not? We train the Saudi Arabian army, and that is much, much, much worse. No doubt Belarusia will come up in the course of the programme this evening. We'll be talking to Chris Hedges about all things American, and we'll be talking to Lee Stranahan, who used to work for Breitbart. Steve Bannon was his boss, and Steve Bannon is now in jail on charges of having profited mightily from a crowdfunding drive to build Donald Trump's wall, which came as a surprise to me because I believed Donald Trump that the Mexicans were going to pay for Donald Trump's wall. Evidently not. $25 million was raised in this crowdfunding drive. And it is alleged, only alleged, of course, that Steve Bannon trousered $1 million of those $25 million. For his own personal expenses. Now, I've only met Steve Bannon once, very powerful individual indeed. And of course, many people think he's the reason why Donald Trump is in the White House in the first place. And the charging of Bannon just before the presidential election may or may not be coincidental. We'll hear from Lee Stranahan, who's no fan of Steve Bannon, about that later. And of course, we'll be talking about the coronavirus. Another big outbreak in Scotland at a meatpacking plant. It's going to be hard to pin that one on the English, but the Scottish figures are catastrophic. And the Sunday Post, of all papers, broke a story today that might see the end of the Scottish Health Minister, Jean Freeman, because it gives the lie to the SNP's protestations that shifting pensioners out of hospital into care homes, where thousands of them have died, was actually at the direction of the Minister for Health. We'll touch on that, I think, with Brian Wilson also very shortly in the programme. But in England, it's no better at all. The more you look at it, England and Scotland have performed catastrophically in the coronavirus epidemic. By comparison with all other countries, except the United States and Brazil, at a push, although Brazil's density of population, size of population, gives it something of a buy in this regard, Scotland and England have performed catastrophically. We have the worst coronavirus figures in Europe, and we have the worst recession in Europe. In fact, we've got one of the worst recessions anywhere in the world. So things look bleak for Britain as we approach the bell on Hogmanay on New Year's Eve, after which Britain finally, totally withdraws from the European Union. Not the year that Boris Johnson imagined when he said this is going to be a great year for Britain. Now you can vote, was Boris Johnson driven out of his holiday cottage by A, midges, 13%, B, a domestic, 18%, C, Scottish nationalists, 69%. That's probably a fairly canny appreciation of the balance of possibilities in this. You can vote on my Twitter feed at George Galloway. Now, Chris Hedges is journalist, writer, activist. He's been on the show before. We got record numbers when he was, because he's one of the most important voices in America. And here he is, just for you, on the Mother of All Talk Shows. Chris, thanks for coming back on the show. Let's start, if we may, with the shock news that Donald Trump's consigliere, Steve Bannon, is in the clink. What happened?
Well, it's part of a long pattern of malfeasance and corruption, emblematic in Trump's own approach to power and government. Remember, he ran Trump University, the sham university, where he defrauded students. And this is just another scam playing on the desperation and the despair of people to raise $25 million, supposedly, to build a small section of a wall, which, by the way, is not even functionable. And then, of course, they siphoned it off, abandoned supposedly $1 million. So these people are just crooks. It's a kleptocracy. Well, I would argue, you know, you can go back. The Democratic administration was a kleptocracy, but the Trump administration is kind of kleptocratic government on steroids.
I was just about to say that, just for balance. The Clintons were pretty kleptocratic also.
Yeah, I mean, this is just naked. There's no veil. There's no pretense. I think that you could argue, going all the way back now, probably to the Clinton presidency, the consent of the governed has kind of been a cruel joke. It's been what John Ralston Saul calls a corporate coup d'etat. The Clintons were very much a part of that move by the Democratic Party to sublimate itself to corporate power and corporate interests. So, of course, with a series of programs, NAFTA, deregulating the Federal Communications Commission, which allowed a half dozen corporations to consolidate control of the airwaves, 90% of what Americans listen to or watch. Glass-Steagall, which ripped down the firewalls between commercial and investment banks, the destruction of welfare and under our welfare system, our old welfare system, 70% of the recipients were children, the explosion of mass incarceration, militarizing police, out-of-control defense budgets. That was all characterized the Democratic Party all the way back to the Clinton administration. And what they got was corporate money, so that by the 90s, they had fundraising parity with the Republican Party. So, yes, but it is a more overt, a cruder form of kleptocratic rule. But, yes, you're exactly right. This isn't a particularly new phenomena.
Yeah, I mean, now that we've established that one group of crooks are fighting another group of crooks for the presidency in November, you have my sympathies. How's that race looking to you?
I mean, from the polls, and the polls were wildly inaccurate in 2016, so I think one has to remember that. However, it does look like the Trump White House, the Republican grip on power is in serious trouble. However, I think that the social dislocation in the United States, which is already bad, is about to become catastrophic because the $600 in extra unemployment benefits has run out. The moratorium on evictions and foreclosures has run out. We've utterly failed to control the pandemic. An estimated 300,000 Americans will be dead by December, and health experts are saying that number could rise to 400,000 by January. Tens of millions of people are being thrown into destitution. And of course, with the moratorium on evictions and foreclosures, will be tossed out of their home. And I think that social collapse, we go all the way back and look at Weimar Germany, or when I covered the former Yugoslavia, which brings with it a complete loss of faith in the ruling elites, can open a Pandora's box of ills that no one can predict. And I think that for me, it's just the utter myopia on the part of the ruling elites not to respond to what's happening. So we're headed into a very volatile fall in the United States, and we already have massive street protests under the out-of-control lethal violence by militarized police forces in poor communities. The average over, actually, 3 Americans are murdered every single day by police, almost all of them unarmed, and disproportionately, they are people of color.
As you describe it, and I've listened to you many times do so, it is a dystopian, apocalyptic even, vision. One struggles to imagine where it could lead. I mean, I think it's fair to say it's not going to lead to a mass socialist uprising of the masses in the United States. Maybe a right-wing populist uprising, maybe almost a military coup. I'm searching for ways of expressing that without using that term. But if this apocalypse over the winter comes to pass, it's difficult to see how the existing political institutions in the United States can cope with that.
Yeah, that's exactly right, because the existing political institutions in the United States by both Democratic and Republican administrations have been hollowed out. I mean, even as I speak, we have 200,000 people who are unhoused in this country, sleeping in their cars or on streets under bridges. Real unemployment is probably close to 20% because they fixed the figures. So if you work 1 hour a week in the United States, you're counted as employed. If you stop looking for work, you're magically erased from the unemployment rolls. If you're furloughed from your work, and we have 40-some million people who've been pushed out of work, you're still counted as employed. And remember, in the United States, health insurance is usually or often tied to its employee sponsored. It comes through your employees. So we're seeing another 27 million people who are expected to lose their health insurance. And I think if you look at the way Wall Street is responding, of course, the billionaire class is just accruing massive amounts of money because of the consolidation of power. But Wall Street is, or the banks, the big banks, are not lending any money at all because they know what's coming. And so they're stockpiling huge reserves of cash to cope with what they know will be a wave of bankruptcies and defaults on student loans, on mortgages, on car loans, on personal loans, on credit card debt. I can't see, I agree with you, that this is going to go anywhere good. We have, in essence, allowed a system to arise the political philosopher Sheldon Wolin calls inverted totalitarianism, but complete control. We're the most watched, spied upon, monitored, photographed population in human history, as Edward Snowden so courageously exposed. Especially, we have seen the stripping away of basic constitutional rights, due process, habeas corpus. So all of the tools are there to really, at the flick of a switch, both legally and physically, and we've seen it in the streets of our cities, to create a kind of militarized authoritarianism, no matter who's in power.
And yet, in this sea of troubles that you describe so peerlessly, instead of concentrating on the domestic problems of the United States, we've had all week the United States foreign policy arm throwing its weight around in the most extraordinary way. Mike Pompeo, for example, having risibly failed at the Security Council to re-enter the Iran nuclear deal in order to, as it were, cancel it, even though the United States had already left it. Pompeo then described America's oldest allies in Europe as being on their knees to the Ayatollahs, tools of the Ayatollahs, and so on. They appear utterly unself-conscious about the problems their own country is facing.
Yeah, I mean, the empire is dying, and it shows all of the morbid signs of decay of any dying empire, including a kind of irrelevancy, increasing irrelevancy on the world stage. I mean, the inability on the part of the United States to cope effectively with a pandemic. Over 5 million Americans, and that number is considered incredibly low, has exposed the American model of corporate capitalism and its imperial might as bankrupt. It has, I think, seen, and as you correctly point out, even our closest allies turn their back on the United States. And so you have figures like Pompeo's as buffoonish and ignorant and myopic as Trump, essentially playing the role of the clown, which I think is perhaps the right word for the particular moment at the United Nations you described.
Malvolio. The situation will not improve if the Democrats come in. Most of the wars, I was just watching a movie last night, an Australian movie, about what was a latter-day Gallipoli in 1966 in Vietnam, when Australian and New Zealand troops were left up the creek without a paddle by the United States, who were their allies. They went there to fight alongside the United States, more fool them. These were all democratic wars. It's not likely, is it, that the foreign policy arm of President Joe Biden and Kamala Harris are going to be any better?
No, you're exactly right. It's not just the wars that have always enjoyed liberal support, in part because the Democratic Party wants to show that it is robust and hawkish and tough. It's also the Democratic Party, especially under the Clinton administration, with Biden taking a leading role, that double the size of our prison population, 2.3 million Americans incarcerated, 25% of the world's prison population, although we are only 4% of the world's population. And what you've seen as a response, especially to the protests in the streets, is kind of gaslighting on the part of the Democratic establishment. So, I mean, the perfect example would be the mayor of Washington, D.C., Muriel Brower. So she has the words Black Lives Matter painted in 35-foot-tall letters on a street near the White House. At the same time, she has proposed a $45 million increase in the police budget and the construction of a $500 million new jail. And this, I think, characterized the kind of sentimental drivel that defined the Democratic Party convention. Nancy Pelosi using a kente scarf as a prop. You know, the the Biden speaking at George Floyd's funeral. But I don't think it's going to work this time around. So yes, there's in substance there is no difference, and in many ways the liberals are worse. And their response, as it has been in the past, is gaslighting to the public. But for the kids in the streets, I think they get it. These are systemic problems. I don't think they're buying, you know, what the Democratic Party is attempting to do. And I think many people feel the response is they're not going to vote, which is going to help Trump.
Well, finally, and I'm grateful for your time, as always, Chris, this was the time for your old friend Bernie Sanders, wasn't it? How Sanders could have electrified this political juncture that we are at, how he could have mobilized the millions of people who have been unsettled or devastated even by these events. This was his moment, and he blew it.
Yeah, completely. I mean, Sanders has always been a creature of the Democratic Party. People forget, although he's registered as an independent and says he's a socialist. He campaigned for Bill Clinton in 1996. This was after NAFTA, after the Omnibus Crime Bill, which did all militarize the police and expanded the prison population and doubled and tripled the lengths of sentences, including the three strikes you're out law, which have seen people incarcerated in the United States for life. Largely for drug offenses, for nonviolent crimes. And he missed, I think, in 2016, his political moment when many of his own delegates walked out of the Democratic Convention in 2016 to protest the way the Democratic Party establishment had fixed the game. He was a loyal kind of poodle to Chuck Schumer, the Democratic leader in the Senate. And once again, of course, they conspired to bring him down. So I think his stature was hurt in 2016. He would campaign for Hillary Clinton and be lucky to bring a few hundred people out to a rally, whereas when he was fighting Clinton for the nomination, he could draw 10,000. So yes, Sanders has proved a tremendous disappointment, but I think I know Bernie not well. I've met him and talked to him about this issue. And I think it's because he understands that if he defies the Democratic Party establishment and he caucuses with the Democrats in the Senate, so he gets his seniority there through the Democratic Party, that will be taken away from him. He will be demonized and they will destroy his political career in Vermont. And I think in the end, it comes down to careerism. He's neither temperamentally or finally morally equipped to lead the kind of fight that has to be fought.
He could have been a contender. Thanks very much.
Yeah, well, he decided not to be.
Yeah, thanks very much, as always. Chris Hedges, journalist, writer, activist extraordinaire. Thanks for joining us. Poll number one. Was Boris Johnson driven out of his holiday cottage by A, midges, 14%, up 1, B, a domestic, 16%, down 2, C, Scottish Nationalists, 70%, up 1. You can vote on my Twitter feed. There's been one problem after another of late in the SNP, and I haven't even had to mention the Alex Salmond affair, which has taken a very dramatic turn indeed, with the inquiry set up by the Scottish Parliament, chaired by an SNP member of the Parliament, and ruthlessly chaired in a way which is raising eyebrows everywhere in the country. It's normal in politics, when you have a sea of troubles like this, to point over there. In this case, the over there is the hate crimes bill that Hamza Youssef, the SNP's justice secretary, has just introduced. It's gone down like a lead balloon in all parts of Scotland, across all political persuasions. Brian Wilson has a thing or two to say about it, and I'm glad to say he joins me now on Skype. Brian, thank you for joining us on the Mother of All Talk Shows. Just explain to the viewers and listeners, what is the purported
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Reason for introducing this bill, and then we'll analyze it.
Well, there's a whole body at present, George, of hate crime legislation in Scotland, as elsewhere. And what is happening basically here, and the perfectly reasonable justification for legislation, is to update, bring together all these existing pieces of legislation into one new and updated one. Now, that sounds innocent enough, would have general support. Everybody's against hate crime. But of course, it doesn't stop there. It goes on to create new crimes. And that's where the difficulty arises. And I think what's probably happened here is, you know, it's become a sort of, there's a lot of political correctness been injected into it. It's a sort of pressure group box ticking exercise at the various contributions that have been made. And you end up something which an incredibly wide range of opinion in Scotland regards as downright dangerous when you have the Catholic Church telling us that it is going to create an intolerant and illiberal Scotland, then something's going on. When you add in the Scottish Police Federation, which represents almost every policeman in Scotland, is, you know, saying essentially that this whole thing is mad and is going to give them a role that they're just not equipped to fulfil in defining hate crime, and so on through the Law Society of Scotland. Everybody saying, and the key to it is the new offence that they have added in, where you don't just have to have the motivation of stirring up hatred, but it's a crime if you're perceived to have stirred up hatred. So if I just get the phrase that having regard to all the circumstances, hatred is likely to be stirred up thereby, then that becomes an offence. Well, you know Scotland as well as I do, and there is virtually nothing that is said in Scotland that somebody wouldn't take offence at. And if every one of them goes running to the police, then you can understand why the Scottish Police Federation envisage a somewhat increased workload.
Now, despite the rather murky origins of the SNP, they have become a paragon of social and political correctness. They are achingly politically correct. So, for example, if I said, as I do every day, that a trans man is not a woman, no matter how much they'd like to be, no matter how much even they believe themselves to be, that a man cannot become a woman, that would be a hate crime under this bill.
Well, fortunately, I'm not a police officer, so I'll never have to adjudicate on that. But the absurd thing is that a police officer might have to adjudicate on that, because you've certainly touched on an area where there would be objections to any such statement, that someone would feel insulted, and therefore, perceiving themselves to be the victim of a hate crime, they would go to the police. The last thing I want to do is to get into that debate, but it is a very good example of where, you know, that somebody, and this is where the Catholic Church, for instance, their concern is that, you know, they have beliefs which may no longer be majority beliefs about society, and particularly around issues of procreation and gender and so on. But there surely were legitimate points of view which are there to be disagreed with. But if someone interprets them as an attack on them, and objects, does not simply disagree with them, but objects to the right to express them, then potentially an offence is created. So I'd keep it as general as that. And I think it's very easy to see why so many people see this as downright pernicious. But certainly, and actually, the whole transgender thing has been brought into the scope of the legislation, so it's actually teeing it up. For exactly the sort of impossible dilemma for those called on to enforce it that you describe.
Yeah, I appreciate you don't want to get into it. So let me just say this: when an SNP MP brings a transvestite into a school library and exposes young children to the whole question of transvestism, if I object to that, am I generating hatred? That's the kind of ridiculous question that will be raised. The church believes that the Bible itself would become a standing offence under this legislation.
Well, that the Catholic Church have certainly said that, and other churches have raised the similar objections. I think one of the things which strikes me is, you know, that nothing is fixed in time. If you go back 40, 50 years in Scottish society, when Scottish Presbyterianism was absolutely dominant within the society, then I've no doubt that an extraordinarily large number of people in Scotland would have found, let's say, Billy Connolly's sketch on the Last Supper would have been stirring up hatred against religion. Now, would they have gone to the police? Of course, some of them would have gone to the police. You know, I've no doubt that if Father Ted would have been grossly offensive to many Catholics. But the idea that it was stirring up hatred, they might think it, but it certainly wouldn't have been a criminal offence. So you then go forward, and there will be other opinions which now seem outlandish, but in 20, 30 years' time may be seen as absolutely legitimate grounds for debate. Now, once you create this offence of perception being enough to justify a prosecution for a hate crime, you're into totally uncharted waters. And as the Police Federation say, you're asking the police in the first instance and then the courts to make judgments on things that are absolutely none of their business and which are probably in breach of Article 10 of the European human rights.
No. Isn't it passing strange that a nationalist movement, which is, as we speak almost, carrying banners around Scotland's airports, roundly condemned by Edinburgh Airport this week, England out of Scotland, ghouls are at the border telling people, including me, I should tell you, to F off out of Scotland. Hate crime? Don't make me laugh. It's the SNP or their camp followers, bedraggled camp followers at the border, I can tell you, who are doing more to generate hatred in Scotland than anybody else I can imagine.
Well, they're certainly doing more to, in the mainstream, they're certainly doing more to create division in Scotland than anyone else. And on the fringes, or sometimes not that far on the fringes, they are using language which is offensive and abusive. And anyone like myself or yourself or many others, not enough others, who challenge them, then we know the torrents of abuse that are showered upon us. I mean, things have changed so much. I was an MP for 18 years. I think I got three abusive letters, because at that time people had to, they had to go out and buy paper, they had to buy green ink, and then they had to buy a postage stamp. So it didn't happen very much. But then social media, all we need is a keyboard and thousands of them descend on you with awful abuse. Now, I've no doubt that has a deeply detrimental effect on Scottish public life, Scottish debate, and so on, because many, many people in the media and in politics, indeed, are intimidated into silence. You need fairly broad shoulders. But by and large, I don't want to prosecute these. I don't want to criminalise people for being offensive and, in some cases, disgusting. But insofar as I do, these these existing laws are in place when they overstep the mark. But actually to give me the right that every time I feel insulted or offended by one of these people, that I can go to the police, it is just, it is ridiculous. But very significantly, George, of course, in all the, you know, the categories of, you know, of people who are to be covered by this legislation, as I say, you know, ticking every pressure group box, there is a total silence on stirring up hatred on political grounds. Every other grounds, age grounds, gender grounds, religious grounds, all of these things, but in political grounds, there is no mention of it.
Now, finally, and I'm grateful for your time, Brian, neither of us are fans of Boris Johnson, but if it wasn't the midges that drove him out of Wester Ross, it's a pretty rum state of affairs, isn't it, that the Prime Minister has to scarper after 3 days with his young child and his partner because he's been fingered by somebody somewhere. And that needs to be inquired into exactly. Who was that somebody somewhere? Have you got a view on that?
I think it's despicable that he, if it became necessary for him to leave. You know, if I look back, you know, Alec Douglas-Hume didn't have to go on holidays in Scotland because he owned half of Lanarkshire. Mrs. Thatcher, when she came, she went to Ireland and stayed with the Tory grandees, the Morrisons of Devizes, who owned most of Islay. You know, and these things. So this guy, you know, I've got no time for Boris Johnson, but if he actually comes, you know, rents a house, a wee house in Wester Ross, you know, pitches his tent, tries to get a bit of private time, then that's seems to me entirely his right. And the whole scenario, which sadly is indicative of where Scotland now is and the division that we spoke about now, is that some people, probably not that far away from the hierarchy of the SNP, you know, decide to make it their business to make his life a misery, to make it impossible for him to stay, and that's, you know, that is not what I associate with the Highlands, or but sadly it is kind of what I associate with the way Scotland is at the present time.
I said finally, but you've reminded me of your latest column. An absolutely brilliant coruscating. You've all I've known you for, goodness knows, nearly 50 years. And you've always been talking about land ownership in Scotland. Mm. And your latest column, brilliant one, was about the Duke of Buccleuch, who seems to own most of the borders, almost up to Edinburgh. Just in a nutshell, what's your gripe with him?
I think Buccleuch's of, I think it's 230,000 acres, and they probably get us up into through the borders up into Lanarkshire, and they probably just about meet the Douglas-Humes. So, it's a logical extension. What it arises out of is that a tiny portion, I think about 10,000 acres of moorland, really, of within the Buccleuch estates, you know, there is a community movement to buy it out, and to increase public access, to develop its natural heritage and all the rest of it, all worthy things. But the Buccleuch's are looking for £6 million from it. Now, what the Buccleuch's and every other estate owner in Scotland now knows is there's a thing called the Scottish Land Fund, which I actually was instrumental in establishing, and it's meant to buy community, it's meant to support community buyouts of land. But if landowners are allowed to set the prices for these things, then, you know, it'll be doomsday before any Scottish land fund can possibly significantly change the structure of land ownership in Scotland, which, of course, is the most inequitable in Europe. So do the Buccleuch's really need another £6 million? The Scottish Land Fund has put in £1 million, but that still leaves the people behind us with £5 million to find in order to retrieve a small area of the Buccleuch estates for public use. So I think it's a case which highlights the whole question. if you're serious about land reform, then you cannot allow the landowners to set the price, and you need a legislative mechanism to underpin that. Now, we did that as a Labour government, and you know, and made some progress. But again, going back to the true nature of nationalism, that they'll feed off the sort of, you know, the anti-landlord thing, but in terms of actually doing anything about it, they just aren't at the races. They're not interested, and they would much rather live with the Duke of Buccleuch than they would, you know, actually legislate. If it put as much effort into legislating on land reform as they have done into the thing we were talking about earlier, then you might actually see some social change in Scotland, which at present is not a reality.
Brian Wilson, thanks for joining us on the Mother of All Talk Shows. Was Boris Johnson driven out of his holiday cottage by midges, 14, a domestic, 15, Scottish Nationalists, 71? You can vote on my Twitter feed. Now, my next guest would almost certainly fall foul of this hate crime bill in Scotland. He better not seek any gigs at the Edinburgh Festival. It's Konstantin Kysin. He's a Russian-British comedian, and he made headlines in 2018 when he refused to sign a behavioural agreement. A comedian asked to sign a behavioural agreement form, which requested that certain topics, including race, sex, and homophobia, should be discussed. A comedian doesn't discuss, he tells jokes, but should be discussed in a, quote, non-abusive way. When asked to perform at a fundraising gig for UNICEF at SOAS, SOAS pointed out it did not require speakers to sign any form of contract, but Kysin chose not to perform at the charity gig. He told Radio 1, BBC Radio 1 Newsbeat, the experience reflects a growing trend on free speech becoming stifled on university campuses across the UK. I think we should meet him, don't you? Konstantin Kysin, host of Trigonometry, a YouTube show. Konstantin, thanks for joining us. You sound like my kind of comedian. I'll need to check you out. I know my wife is a fan of your work. Let's start with this university campuses thing. I spent 30 years, more than 30 years, speaking on university campuses. I will not now go to a university campus for the very reason that you have identified, that they are not a safe space for a person with a different point of view. That's what you found, yeah?
That's exactly right, George. When people talk about safe spaces or inclusive spaces, what they really mean is that people like you and people like me and people from all over the political spectrum who have opinions that don't fit within this narrow, woke, progressive agenda, we're all excluded from these very inclusive spaces, rather. We're not welcome there. They're not safe for us. And in fact, those of us that do go will encounter sometimes what they call no platforming. Sometimes people will physically disrupt the events. We've seen in America where people are attacked, beaten up, etc. So there is a very new sort of authoritarianism that's happening on campus. And as we're starting to see with this crime bill in Scotland, and as we saw with the prosecution of Count Dankula, Marcus Meekham, a couple of years ago in Scotland again, it's bleeding out into wider society.
Now, I've had both those things, no platforming and physical attack, Aberdeen University, of all places. So I no longer accept invitations. But when did this become a thing? And who do you hold responsible for it?
Well, I think it became really a thing probably very much in the last 5 to 6 years in the way that it has. And who I blame for it is the universities themselves. Yeah. Jonathan High and Greg Lukianoff wrote a book called The Coddling of the American Mind, in which they chronicle the fact that over the last 50 to 60 years, there's been a monoculture in the faculty of universities. So they've gone from being, broadly speaking, sort of balanced in terms of left and right, to now where it's almost exclusively people on the left, in many cases on the very far left, who dominate the faculty. And these people are indoctrinating young people, and many of them are coming from schools, which are doing the same thing, with this sort of way of thinking, where words are violence, speaking your mind is abusing other people, it's literally hurting them, etc., etc. And they've reframed language. They're literally destroying the meanings of words. They're pretending that things mean something that they don't in order to drive home a very, very radical political agenda.
It's the dictatorship of the prevailing orthodoxy, and the prevailing orthodoxy in this country and in the US and across much of the world is this politically correct political orthodoxy. In Aberdeen University, I was physically assaulted, but the university did nothing at all about it. Neither did the police, even though there was a packed hall of about 500 people who all saw it happening. And that was the point at which I said no more. But you could kind of understand it, although I would still deplore it, for a politician. But as I read out there, you are a comedian and you are asked to discuss issues in this politically correct way. But then you don't discuss issues. You're a comedian. You make jokes about things. It's outrageous, isn't it, that a comedian should be treated in this way?
Well, one of the things about people who have no sense of humor, which is what these people really are, George, is that they take everything literally. They don't understand that when someone makes a joke, they don't necessarily mean what they say. Sometimes we use irony, we use sarcasm, where we actually say the opposite of what they mean, and we rely on people to use their common sense, to use their intelligence, to understand other things that we're doing on stage, the way we say things, to understand what we're really getting at. But if your intention is to be offended, if your intention is to be upset, if your intention, as it is with these people, to attack others for saying the wrong thing and to create this hyper-vigilant culture where you can say nothing, then they, of course, will take things literally. They will misinterpret jokes. They will misunderstand what you say and deliberately use it against you. Now, I do think that there's a bit of a pushback against it happening. My YouTube show, Trigonometry, which I invite you to come on, and many of our fans would be keen to see you there. Sure. You know, we talk about these things. We talk with people who've experienced it. And I think your experiences, certainly by the standards of the UK, what sounds like what happened to you at Aberdeen University, you know, is very serious. I wonder if you'd said something offensive, maybe the police would have been quicker to act, certainly to deal with you, as opposed to dealing with the people who are actually attacking you. That seems to be another thing with our police at the moment. They're too busy sort of virtue signaling and bending the knee to all these things instead of actually dealing with crime.
By the way, Constantine, I was attacked by transgender activists. At a point, I was still a member of parliament at the time, at a point when I had never uttered a single word about that subject ever in private or in public. It wasn't a thing for me. I was attacked by transgender activists for nothing. And neither the police nor the authorities did anything about it. Now, you think these people are far left. I think they're liberals. Some are Trotskyites who are liberals of a kind anyway. I think they're small L liberals. And here's the irony. I've lived long enough that it was the liberals who demanded an end to censorship in this country. The abolition of the Lord Chancellor's right to stop stage shows, to ban films and books and so on. But it's now the same kind of political mindset, this liberalism, that is doing the banning, doing the censoring.
Mm, It is. I mean, I don't know. These words get all very messy and complicated when we talk about the far left or the liberals or whatever. I prefer to call these people woke, which I think is a word that describes them very well.
Yeah.
The reason I say far left, and you will know this, George, because you know you're very educated on these things. Political correctness comes from my country, from Russia, from the Soviet Union. It was a word that was introduced by Lenin to say if people were outspoken, like many of my family, and they were criticizing the policies of the party, let's say, people would say to them, well, comrade, that is factually correct, but it's politically incorrect. So many of these people are relying on the legacy of the far left, the legacy of communism, the legacy of authoritarianism. And what we're seeing now, you know, I'm not nearly as old and wise as you are, but I remember a time when it was the right that was censorious. It was the right that shut people up. It was the right that banged on about rap lyrics and all that sort of thing. Now what we're seeing, I think, is that it's the progressive left, the so-called progressive left, who have become the new censors in chief. They want to shut everybody up. And the reason they'll attack someone like you, who hasn't said anything about, in that point, transgenderism or anything like that, is that they understand that people who speak their mind, you know, you and I may disagree on things, but we are people who speak our mind about things. We are fundamentally a threat to the whole movement because their movement relies on only allowing people to speak who agree with them.
Well, I really hope to work with you again, Constantine. Just tell us how people can watch your YouTube show and when it goes out.
Yes, it goes out every Wednesday and Sunday. It's called Trigonometry, as in trigger in a gun. And the idea is we discuss controversial and difficult issues in a lighthearted and interesting way with brilliant guests. I hope you'll be one in the future. And people can find it. We're on Twitter at TriggerPod, on Facebook as well. And of course, on YouTube itself, just search for Trigonometry or Constantine Kissin. Thank you very much for having me, George.
Done deal. You're a good man. Thanks very much indeed for coming on the Mother of All Talk Shows. Now, Lee Stranahan is not just an ace investigative reporter, he's the founder of the Citizen Journalism School. And he knows Steve Bannon very well. He used to work for him. And so when I discovered that Bannon had been arrested, I reached out for my old friend, Lee Stranahan, who joins us now. Lee.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome back to the Mother of All Talk Shows. Were you greatly surprised at your former employer being huckled by New York's finest?
Well, yes and no. I was not surprised that he was going to get in trouble eventually. And I wasn't surprised that this project that he was arrested on, We Build the Wall, when I heard that, I've been talking about this for about a year, about Bannon's involvement with We Build the Wall. I was surprised because nobody knew it was, I didn't know it was coming. But I'll tell you, I'm not the only former Breitbart employee who's none too pleased about it either. A lot of ex-Breitbart employees are smiling, some publicly, but some privately. And I've already heard from some people who used to work for Steve that Steve Bannon, he's a populist, right, who was making $1 million a year at Breitbart. He was making double in 1 month what I was making, and I was one of the highest paid reporters in a year, George. So that's not much of a populist, in my opinion.
No, he likes the high life. Do you think that's what's led to this? He likes fancy hotels, private planes, and all of that. Has he been, as it were, running an expense account at the expense of this crowdfunding thing?
I think it's more than that. Andy Badalato is another person who was arrested, and I know Andy too. And Andy's one of Steve's oldest friends. And again, there's no personal, I like Andy personally, for instance. He's always been nice to me. But Andy told me something about Steve Bannon about 3 years ago. He said, Steve's a guy who believes that one day there will be statues of him erected in the world. He sees himself like a Julius Caesar, a Napoleon, a George Washington, the kind of person statues, you know, are built about. And that's the way Bannon, you'll see this in books, people who know Steve, he sees himself that way. And I think it's a combination. He'd gone out of Trump's good graces. Money is power, right? And so it wasn't just the lifestyle, because you can tell by the way he dresses, he's not, you know, he's not into the lifestyle all the way. It's hard to categorize him as a fashion plate. But I think it's the power as much as the money with Steve. And like I say, I had been told about a year ago by somebody who worked at the We Build the Wall project, a friend of mine. They worked there before Steve came in. And since then, my friend's Dustin Stockton. Dustin since then has had federal officials seize his phone. But Dustin warned me a year ago. He said, Steve has completely taken over this project. And he said, it's weird, and I don't want to have anything to do with it. But he said, Bannon's completely taken over. So that's the part that didn't surprise me at all, George.
Could it be politically motivated? Was he on the verge of a comeback in the Trump campaign, for example?
Well, okay, so two things can be true, right? They can have him dead to rights on this, which it seems to me that they do, and it's politically motivated. Does that make sense? Just because they arrest you and it's politically motivated doesn't mean they don't have you on something.
Sure.
And I think it's both. For instance, this indictment was made by the Southern District of New York. That Southern District of New York, first off, they're right at the heart of Russiagate. They're the ones who, for instance, indicted Natalia Veselnitskaya. She's the Russian lawyer who was in the Trump Tower meeting. She did nothing wrong. Natalia did nothing wrong. So SDNY, Southern District of New York, has been right at the center of the anti-Trump stuff. So, and by the way, you know, so let's just stop right there. I think clearly this is Southern District of New York trying to leverage Bannon to rolling on Trump the same way they did with my friend Roger Stone. But there was nothing to roll on. I don't think Bannon has anything to roll on. The problem is Bannon will lie. If you look at his testimony in Roger Stone's courtroom trial, it directly contradicted what he said under oath up on Capitol Hill. So Bannon's a guy who will say whatever he needs to say. So this could get quite interesting, George, and it could have, and with the election coming up, the craziest election I've ever seen in the United States, absolutely insane due to COVID and everything else, the protests, everything else. We'll see. I think this is part of a plan clearly to take down Trump, but I really don't know if it will.
There's not much time left, is there? The election is looming, so there's no way that Bannon will be on trial this year, for example. I'm sure that the wheels of justice grind exceeding slow in your country, as indeed in this one.
Yeah.
Is he actually behind bars as we speak?
No, he was bailed out. So he was on a yacht in Connecticut with this Chinese billionaire he's been palling around with. And then he was arrested, handcuffed, brought into court, and he faced, I believe the number is $5.4 million in bail, okay? He walked, but you don't have to pay the whole bail amount. He walked, George, you'll be empathetic. He only had to pay $1.75 million out of pocket to get out of jail.
Wow.
So, you know, feel badly for Steve.
And no time scale for a trial yet.
No time scale. But here's the other thing to factor in here. A few weeks ago, Marco Rubio, who's part of the Senate Intel Committee panel, said he thinks Bannon should be indicted. So there were already these things going. And by the way, the media here is not reporting this. Donald Trump, about a month ago, came out against this We Build the Wall project. A month ago. So it becomes interesting. Did Trump know something was coming? did he get a question about it from someone who knew something was coming? There's leaks galore here in our justice system, particularly with the Southern District. So we'll see if there's more pressure that's going to be applied to Bannon before the end of the year.
Now, it's a slight digression, but not really. You talked about this crazy election season. We now have the relatives of Donald Trump writing books and being illicitly tape recorded, slagging him off in the strongest possible term. They're not a very functional family, the Trumps.
No, you know, I mean, when I found out that the woman, Mary Trump, about 55, she secretly taped a couple of dozen hours of conversations with the 83-year-old sister of Donald Trump, who's a judge. You know, that's untoward. She didn't, the judge didn't know she was being taped.
No.
And so there's certainly been times in my life when I wouldn't have wanted my family members secretly taped talking about me at various points. And I think everybody can identify with that in any sort of large family, you know. So I found that pretty disgusting, actually.
Has it damaged them? Has the book damaged them? I bought it. It's actually quite powerful. Of course, it's party pre. It's designed to wound, if not to kill. But it's quite powerfully written. Has it damaged them? It's sold a lot of copies.
Not at all. Hasn't damaged them at all. In fact, here's an example, George, of how little it's damaged them. Don't forget, Biden is running basically as I'm not Trump. He's not a policy guy. He's not talking about policies. And all the progressives here in the U.S. aren't buying the Biden thing. He's very unpopular with progressives. Meanwhile, what was announced this morning? The RNC, the Republican National Committee, announced that Donald Trump will be speaking every single night at the Republican convention. This is unheard of. Every single night. So basically, the Democrats are saying, we're going straight after Trump. And Trump is saying, bring it on. Bring it on. Come on. Let's do this. Let's do this. And you know what? I think this is a very smart move on Trump's part. I may not like it, and I don't like it, by the way. I'm a policy person, but the cult of personality around Trump is vivid. And, you know, that's one of the mistakes Bannon made. Bannon thought he could do Trump without Trump. He thought the ideas of Trump were the thing that really motivated the base. And unfortunately, I say this unfortunately because I wish it weren't true about human nature, but it's absolutely Bannon failed. You can't have Trump without Trump because his personality is the thing people respond to. And look at these new press conferences he's doing on COVID. He's not surrounded by 15 people anymore. Since he got a new campaign manager, it's just Trump at the podium. And I think this is a very good move because the fact is Trump versus Biden in a personal basis, I think a lot of undecided voters are still going to go with Trump. He seems, again, whatever you think of him policy-wise, he's strong, and he may contradict himself five times, but whatever he's saying at the moment, he seems to believe, and he says it strongly. And I think there's something about that. They're not worried about, Trump is not worried about the Democrats going after Trump, in other words.
Lee Stranahan, thank you very much indeed. Very nice to see you again. Looking very fine, fit, and healthy. Thanks for joining us. Now, Dr. Ranjit Brar is the Moat's medic, and I'm glad to welcome him back. Although it is sad, Ranjit, that we have to keep on meeting this way. Let me begin by asking you on the vaccine front. You wait for a vaccine, and then two come along at once, and both of them are from Russia. Although the Russians were happy with the first one, they brought out a second one. Can you illuminate that in any way?
George, good to be back with you. I think as we commented last week, there's not a huge amount of data on those two vaccines. I am tremendously optimistic there are several teams around the world who are rising to this challenge, and the Russians have certainly performed extremely well. But, you know, what they're really saying is that these vaccines are going to be given to they're going to general production, George. I mean, we've seen other companies as well, including GlaxoSmithKline, including AstraZeneca, starting to manufacture hundreds of millions of doses prior to them completing their phase three trial. In a sense, a similar thing is happening. So these vaccines, which have been shown to be very efficacious, and shown to have generated good antibody response and to be safe in the small groups they've been tested on, are being put into a wider use, but limited use, alongside of further surveillance of their efficacy and safety. And that will allow them to go, obviously, into use far quicker. And that's really a response measure to this extraordinary health emergency. And I think, you know, I welcome it, though I'm cautious without having more data upon which to base a really definitive opinion, George.
Now, is there a possibility that the whole thing will die out before these vaccines are on the market? By dying out, I don't mean, of course, that the virus will not still be around. But looking at the British figures, the number of people affected is definitely falling, certainly the number of people dying. There was, I think, two died the other day, yesterday, I think. Is that because we're getting used to it, because it's losing virulence? What's your take on that?
I think that's a really good question. I was precisely looking at these figures, trying to ascertain what was going on, George, because 2 weeks ago, there was a sudden dip from every week we were having very regularly, between 400 and 500 deaths a week. Now, then there was a lot of press furore generated around the manner in which those deaths were calculated. It was alleged to be the case that Public Health England were incorrectly categorizing people as having died from COVID-19 when that was not the case. Since then, of course, we've had quite a dramatic announcement that perhaps we can talk a little bit about. The public health announcement will be subsumed by another body, the National Institute for Health Protection, so-called, that's not yet been formed. But those figures have dramatically changed, and they've suddenly, as you say, become one or two a day, three or four a day consistently throughout the last 2 weeks. But it's a very sudden step change. And so whilst it's not been really transparently stated, I think there's a difference in the way that deaths are being categorized. Now, I know for a fact that there are people still languishing. I mean, the number of admissions is definitely much lower in hospital. The number of cases we're seeing is much lower. But as we've commented before, the number of cases is actually rising. And we had some discussion about that before. But I know it's the case that despite a lower number of admissions in hospital, I personally have some colleagues, for example, at the hospital I work in, who I know are still on intensive care being treated for this condition. So it is the case that we are still having deaths from the initial peak. And it's certainly the case that the virus is still spreading. Certainly on a world scale, we've had 2 million more cases since we spoke last week. So on a world scale, there are 23.5 million cases that have been test proven. And I think, you know, a lot of that is hidden. If you look at India, they say they've had 3.1 million and only 57,000 deaths. I think those figures are likely to be wrong because of the manner in which data is collected, the haphazard manner of testing, and the, you know, way in which deaths are reported and traced. The data is very poorly kept, even to the extent that when they wanted to enforce the Citizen Registration Act in India, they couldn't prove, you know, that millions of people were born in India. That's the level of the documentation that they currently have. So I think we're likely to have many more cases around the world, and I'm afraid this isn't going away. There has been some speculation about whether the virus is growing milder, and I've read a couple of kind of popular statements about that. I can't find anything to back that up in terms of the scientific evidence. From the very beginning, we've known that there were different genetic strains of the virus, and that's normal when a virus is being reproduced in millions of copies in one individual and in millions of individuals, and it's being reproduced many, many, many times over. And each time the virus is reproduced, there's the possibility of a mistranslation and therefore a mutation which may or may not be stable and perpetuated. We've seen there was some talk about a particular G614 mutation that was becoming more and more prevalent, and that was thought to be interesting because that mutation was associated with a spike protein. But really, there's been no evidence of it becoming a lot less virulent other than a decreased number of deaths. It may be that with our change in behavior, is unquestionably the case, and you know none of us are enjoying it, but the social distancing, the wearing of masks, the ongoing isolation of people who are most susceptible, that we will change the nature of the virus, that despite the fact it remaining in the community, despite the fact it's have ongoing prevalence, that we see fewer deaths. But that's speculation at this stage. I hope it's the case, but you know, it does seem that our R rate essentially is around one, that there's a large number of cases still prevalent in the community, more than 1,000 being reported a day, and probably, as we said, 4,000 based on antibody studies. And therefore, you know, when schools go back, when the holidays are over, when the summer is over, we're still looking at the possibility of an increase in cases and a resumption of deaths. I very much hope it's not the case, George, but all the indicators and all the worrying factors, I'm afraid, are still there.
I mean, there's lies, damned lies and statistics. It is possible that these numbers cannot be trusted, that at a stroke of a pen, you decide to call something one thing and then to call it something else. It is possible that deaths were overcounted before, over-attributed to the virus. And also possible, though both can be true, that the numbers are now being undercounted. How much trust can we put in these number crunchers?
Well, it's difficult. It's very difficult, George, based on the limited number of tests compared to the world population. The only way of being sure would be to test the entire world population several times over. And clearly that's not possible and not feasible, and therefore a bit like a poll at an election, you have to project based upon limited data. I think that probably the most robust evidence we have was of the excess mortality during the peak, during those months from March to June. There was quite clearly a large increase in excess mortality.
About 70,000.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's pretty widely agreed that those are deaths due to coronavirus, and they are well in excess of the official figures. So there was, in general, an underreporting because of an under-testing at that time. Now, we've got a far wider capacity for testing now. There's a lot of restructuring that's going on of our health system, which I think is very worrying for our health system, because I think an agenda of privatization is being pushed. Some people are attributing, therefore, you know, ulterior motive to those who say that there really is no such thing as COVID. Now, that's totally wrong. There absolutely is COVID. There absolutely were those real excess mortality. It really has caused these problems around the world. But what is equally true is that our government, successive governments that we've had, have their own agenda regarding the state and regarding maximization of profit from certain companies, well, private enterprise, essentially, from the state sector. And they're aggressively pushing that agenda. And I do see the winding down of NHS, public health NHS, and the rolling out of the National Institute of Healthcare Protection as being associated with that trend, George.
Well, we'll talk about that next week if I can bone up on it, because that certainly seems like quite a portentous development. Dr. Ranjit, thanks for joining us on the Mother of All Talk Shows. Should the BBC drop Rule Britannia? A, yes, 19%, up 1. B, no, 66%. And C, drop the proms, 15. That's down 1. You can still vote until 10 minutes to 10 on my Twitter feed, at George Galloway. Let's go to Malcolm in Spain. Go ahead, Malcolm.
Malcolm, yes, heard that one before. George, quick one for you, and I want you to clear something up for me. I mean, belated happy birthday, 66. You've got a new child.
Thank you.
And you seem to be absolutely going for the SNP and about this Scottish thing. And I disagree with you on a few things, but this one is completely, we're on the same page. And I hear callers from Texas and saying, well, Scotland independent. It's almost like a Braveheart background.
Yeah, we've got salmon. We've got salmon, he said, and whiskey.
Salmon, I mean, it's beyond a joke, George. And I hear you. And, you know, I've heard you over the years, and you've nailed your mask. You know, you argue it, and you're so passionate about this right now. And as I say, you should be starting to enjoy your retirement and get out of this. But you're obviously passionate about this, George. And I love you for that, because Scotland is dear to my heart. And you mentioned Andy Robertson, and you mentioned the 16-year-old illegal that's like now in jail in Scotland get the vote. Now, I'm a proud Scot, and my history goes back to Culloden, when 35 of my clansmen died on that day, right? Now, fast forward a few hundred years, and my father married an English woman, and I'm now living in London, and I cannot get a vote on my country's independence. Why is that? And my question to you, George, is why do the SNP fervently try to distance England, who are our friends and our neighbours, who take 60% of our trade? And what, are we going to sell our Orkney cheese in Slovenia? Are we going to sell our Aberdeen Angus all over the world? Why are they doing it? Sturgeon's not stupid. Why is she doing it, George? Please explain that
to
me.
Well, it's a wonderful call, Malcolm. Thanks for it. I have fought the SNP literally all my life. I was a child when I started fighting the SNP in the 1960s. I recall it vividly, standing outside the school gates at election time and so on. I had the misfortune to become politically prominent in the city of Dundee, which had the leader of the SNP as one of its two members of parliament. And an absolute renegade he was too. Everything good that we tried to do, he was our number one critic and enemy. No pretense then that the SNP were somehow left-wing or even socialist. None of that was ever pretended by Gordon Wilson, our MP. The Scottish separatist project would be insane at any time for the reasons you have just adumbrated. In the wake of COVID, we're going to walk out of a union where we have 11% of the seats in the British Parliament. And where in the recent past, we've had governments where virtually every single senior office was held by a Scottish person. Scots are prominent in all kinds of things in the British state, in the armed forces, in the civil service, in the foreign office, in the parliament, and so on. We're going to leave all that and attempt to rejoin, they call it, the European Union. In fact, it wouldn't be rejoining because Scotland was never a member of it. Britain was a member of it. To join the European Union, where we'd have 0.5% of the seats in Parliament, and we'll have no commissioner and zero members of the government, because, of course, the government is hand-picked, and hand-picked in the interests of Germany and France. Scotland would be a tiny dot on the periphery of the European Union. But if it was insane at any time, it's absolutely off the scale insane now. The deficit I talked about, the furlough, the COVID disaster, following on from the financial disaster in 2008, I will expend my last breath, if necessary, trying to save Scotland from this fate. And the reason that I'm energised right now about it, although I was very active in the referendum in 2014, is that next May, Scotland will vote for a new Scottish Parliament. And if the SNP win it, then they will proceed to either demand a legal referendum from the British state, which they will not get, or we'll be off, and you're in Spain now, we'll be off down the Catalonian road. It will be an illegal, illegitimate referendum. They will seek to declare a unilateral declaration of independence, and then we're in very, very dangerous territory, Malcolm. Literally dangerous. We could have another Northern Ireland in Scotland, and I'm determined to avoid it. Last word to you, Malcolm.
Well, I think you've summed up nicely there, George. And my last word would be, you know, it was like Tony Blair was the end of Labour. John Smith, unfortunately, passed away. I think he would have changed the trajectory of Labour, and Tony Blair ruined Labour, and that's it for me, you know?
Me too, Malcolm. Well said. Thanks for the call. Brian is in Motherwell to talk about Bernie Sanders. Go ahead, Brian.
Hello, Mr. Galloway.
Nice to hear from you again. Go ahead, sir.
It's a great pleasure to be on the show. I thought your documentary about the killings of Tony Blair was superb.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
For a long time.
Appreciate that.
Well, I'm pretty much from a similar background as yourself. I'm Scottish with an Irish background, and like my family were old Labour, trade unionists, kind of Tony Benn type Labour.
Yeah.
And one thing that angers me right now is the kind of spinelessness of the left wing. There's been examples of it, like Jeremy Corbyn and like Sinn Féin in Ireland right now. But what I want to focus my attention on is Bernie Sanders in America. I just think probably like yourself during the primary season, I was really excited with Bernie Sanders. Now, there was a period where I thought he was going to become the Democratic nominee.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, he fell away at the end, which is unfortunate. But I just think he capitulated to Biden too early.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I felt like he could have forced Bernie Sanders to do a few executive orders. First of all, like Medicare for all, a single-payer healthcare system, which the American people really need right now, especially when there's a global health pandemic on, and like to end corporate welfare and all these, I don't know we. Always think of like America having a problem with socialism, but they don't seem to have any problem with corporate socialism. All these welfare checks going to like ExxonMobil, which is the biggest corporation on the planet, and yet they're getting money from the government, which is absolutely it's just horrible. And all these international free trade deals as well that is outsourcing American jobs to other countries. I just think that. I think what Bernie Sanders' plan was to wait until Biden becomes president and then twist his arm to pass all these things instead of understanding the leverage now.
He'll not even get in. He'll not even get through the door of the White House. Brian, you're absolutely right. You summed it all up. Bernie Sanders is the biggest disappointment in political history. And if I've not taken him out of my Hall of Fame already, I'm going to do so now. You've reminded me of all the reasons why. Thanks for the call, sir. Chris is in Colchester on the coronavirus. Go ahead, Chris.
Hiya. Well, I think we have to now acknowledge that cases don't necessarily mean deaths and hospitalizations. I think we need to see a difference between the two. Just reading the piece today in the Sunday Express by Professor Cole Hennigan from the Oxford University Centre for Evidence-Based Medicine. He's the leading person of that, saying that COVID testing is so sensitive it could pick up traces of previous infection long after recovery, which could artificially inflate the numbers of positive cases. And he's saying that the population needs to be terrorised because it wasn't quite as deadly as originally thought. And we need to get back on with our lives, he said.
Chris, thanks for that call. It's a familiar refrain from you and others. It's a perfectly legitimate one. Thanks for making it. Glenn is in Carlisle, in England. Go ahead, Glenn.
Hi, George. Pleasure to speak to you once again.
And you, sir.
And congratulations on your... age as child with Gyatri. I appreciate on
Thank
that.
You.
I'm a bit late to the floor.
Thank you. No, it's very kind of you. Very kind.
Happy congratulations. On the subject of, I wanted to speak briefly on the subject of the A-level results. Obviously, the scandal that broke with that last week, because it wasn't that long. It certainly doesn't feel it since I did my A-levels, and I know I have good friends who are doing them now. I think that the way the government or the algorithm and the computer program they implemented to artificially calculate the students' A-level results and was going to be implemented for the GCSEs as well had the news not broke. With how little it took into account the teachers' predicted grades and the expertise the teachers put in and the coursework the students had completed where applicable, I would tend to agree with the people who've pointed out how deliberately elitist, even classist, you could say it was, because it basically the algorithm was preset to calculate predicted grades based on a school's average elite able position over the last year to 2 years by subject and by year group. And so obviously the private schools, the grammar schools, the academies that have private patronage and that have more generous funding, either from parents and parent funding and actual tuition fees or from sponsorship that were higher up the league tables, their students, their A-level students, got the better grades under the algorithm because they had the higher league table positions, and the children from the state-funded schools and the students in the state-funded schools were calculated to have the worst grades by the algorithm, irrespective or virtually irrespective of their existing achievements. I think that was probably done deliberately.
Glenn, I couldn't put it better than that, son. You've summed it up absolutely perfectly. Big algorithm is a class conscious, postcode conscious, mean guy. He didn't mark down the people with the smallest class sizes, which of course is the private schools. He marked down the poorest children in the worst performing schools who have the biggest class sizes. And he, I think, deliberately took a decision to consider the country's teachers to be liars, every man and woman of them, that they could not be trusted to correctly and honestly estimate what their students would have achieved if they had sat their exams. Now, this was a national scandal. They now have had to completely abandon. They've strangled algorithm. And they're now back trusting the teachers that they branded as liars in the weeks and days before this U-turn. And I think this whole thing has been a national scandal. And it is astounding to me that both Gavin Williamson and John Swinney in Scotland are still in their jobs. I don't know how they can look at themselves in the mirror in the mornings. Glenn in Carlisle, thanks for your call. Mike is in the Bahamas, wants to talk about Biden. Go ahead, Mike.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm good, sir. Nice to hear from you.
I want to talk about the DNC platform. I don't see much in it, especially for progressives, but what's going to make people vote for Biden over Trump?
Just that he's
We're not getting anything. We're not getting Medicare
not,
for all.
Just that he's not Trump. That's the whole
well,
pitch,
that's the
isn't
same
it?
Thing that happened in 2016 with right. Hillary Clinton running against Trump. And I voted for Jill Stein.
Yeah.
And this election, I don't even have anyone. I don't think Jesse Ventura is going to actually run. And I'm not excited about the Green Party candidate at all, so I'm not going to vote for him.
I couldn't vote for him, no. I supported
I'm just going to send in
Dr.
an empty
Stein,
ballot.
But I couldn't support
president.
The current candidate. I think that's right, Mike, that people, a large number of people, if Jesse doesn't run, a large number of people will simply stay at home.
They voter shame, but they don't give us anybody to vote for. It's not my job to keep Trump out of the White House. It's the DNC's job and Biden's job. But they give the voters nothing. It's just ridiculous. That's all I really wanted to say.
Well, you've said it very powerfully, and I'm grateful to you for calling us from the Bahamas on that subject. Should the BBC drop Rule Britannia? This is a remarkable poll. This will probably end up in the newspapers tomorrow. 1,279 of you have voted, and 68% of you think that the BBC should not drop Rule Britannia. That's one of our bigger polls, and it's certainly overwhelmingly one of our bigger majorities. Now, Ishmael is in New York, but he wants to talk about Yemen. Go ahead, Ishmael.
Hey, George, really an honor to get an opportunity to talk to you on the show.
Thank you.
I'm a big fan. Always look forward to Sundays as well.
Thanks.
Because of other law talk shows. Yeah. I just wanted to, briefly talk about, Yemen is very, its history as far as, becoming an official country is definitely complicated, as with any, Middle Eastern or, Arab country, right, especially during the colonialization and then the transition from a kingdom to a republic, uniting the North and the South. Now, we currently have this situation, right, which is very, multidimensional, right? It's very complex. The former president tag team with the Houthis to actually, take over replacement government ruled by Mansour Hadi, and he's not really much of a leader, unfortunately. And I mean, unfortunately, not his fault, because half the the army is for the former president, and some are for him. There's a situation with southern separatists. There's a situation with just not having it's just an unstable government. Houthis wanting to take some of Yemen, and then of course the international complexity, right, with Saudi Arabia being a part of the picture, UAE and other, coalitions.
Is the UAE still there, Ishmael? Is the UAE still fighting there?
Yeah, exactly. Especially with the southern separatists. And
they're trying to divide the country. They're trying to partition the country, aren't they? They want a base on the sea.
Exactly. As there's a lot, going on in Yemen. But yeah, I guess my question to you, George, is at the end of the day, I'm really shocked that there's still not a political solution, just because, at the end of the day, it's really the people, the everyday people that are suffering, right? It's, Yemen's not really talked a lot about enough, right? The everyday people, the women, children, even people that are educated can't find a job within their own country. They have to go to neighboring, Saudi Arabia, UAE, and it's a really tough time for them, right? So I guess my question is, what's the solution at this point? And
well,
what do you foresee?
I wish I knew. It's a wonderful call, Ishmael. The hour is against us, but it breaks my heart, the situation in Yemen. Hundreds of thousands of people have been killed, either by famine, cholera, or bombs and missiles. The country is being bled to death, and nobody is interested to talk about it. Britain and the United States are deeply involved with the Saudi Arabian armed forces, and we now discover also with the Belarusian armed forces. It seems that there is no government that we will not try to offer military assistance to if our geopolitical interests are held to be at stake. The disgrace of the poorest country in the Arab world, possibly the poorest country in the whole world, Yemen, being mercilessly bombarded by the richest country in the Arab world, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates. Qatar, I think, has withdrawn from the war. It is a scandal beyond scandal. It's almost impossible to exaggerate how shocking and disgraceful this situation is. Alas, the hour is late, Ishmael. Maybe we'll find a chance to talk about it again. I've got to clear the decks because there's a legend on the line. It's Norma in Bristol. It's Fag Ash Flow. Norma, welcome.
Hello, George. Can you hear me all right? Because my phone's a bit funny tonight.
Yeah, very clearly. The whole world's listening.
Listen, if I hadn't listened to your program tonight, I would have watched the 2007 Plum concert, because it was Simon Bolivar, the National Youth Orchestra of Venezuela. I mean, all these youngsters were originally from poor backgrounds, and I recorded it. And, George, you must see it. It's totally exhilarating.
I always watch the proms. I used to play in an orchestra, Norma.
Yeah, I know. But, I mean, this one is so exhilarating. I don't think anybody who doesn't even like classical music would find it anything but exciting.
What do you think of this Rule Britannia? It's amazing. 69% of our respondents, 1,363 votes, is against dropping Rule Britannia.
I like the tune of
Rule Britannia. I like the tune of Land of Hope and Glory, but I'd have to rewrite the words.
Yeah, I drop Rule Britannia, and I would drop Land of Hope and Glory.
Land of Hope and Glory is a truly lovely tune.
Oh, beautiful!
If we could modernize the words.
Words. Yeah.
Because the tunes mean something to British people.
Yeah, the tunes.
The tunes
lovely.
Really move us, like Jerusalem, for example. The William Blake. These tunes move us.
Yeah, but you know, I never watched The Last Night of the Proms. I just find it, I don't like it, and I don't watch it. And we haven't had any proms because of this coronavirus.
Well, the last time I saw it, the Albert Hall was full of European Union flags.
There were more, yeah. I had the picture because my husband does, but I don't. And they did have it more international. But we have composers from all over the world. And I think the Albert Hall is a lovely venue.
It's fabulous. It's a national treasure.
But we need to be a bit modest and incorporate all the internationalists and not go, Rule Britannia. I hate that.
Yeah, it's a problem, that song. The words of it are a problem. First of all, Britain doesn't rule the waves.
No.
Britain never shall be slaves.
No.
May God always guarantee that. But we took a lot of slaves. And one of the bizarre things when watching the England football team is to hear the crowd singing Rule Britannia when at least half of the team are from the Caribbean and from Africa, where the slaves were taken and to which the slaves were delivered. The words of the song are deeply problematic. The tune is powerful and moving. Last word to you, Norma.
Well, just do watch Simon Bolivar. But the other thing is, I hope you received this copy of a letter that I sent to Moats.
I did. I haven't read it yet. I will read it right after the show.
Yeah, read it after the show because I'd be interested personally in what you think of it.
Yeah, I will do. Norma, it's a joy, as always, to end the show talking with you. It's been marvellous for me. I hope it was for you. I thought it was a great show tonight. And if you agree, then please bring another viewer, bring another listener with you next time. Because we are the biggest show on the planet of its type. We are outgunning all of the so-called mainstream media in terms of our streams, and in terms of viewership of our clips, and we don't even know how many people are merely listening on sputniknews.com, on FM, and on AM. Join us next week, same time, same place.